House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Monday, April 15th, 2024. Let the record reflect the time is 3:17 p.m. Today we have President Representative Prox, Representative Carrick, Representative Fields, Vice Chair Ruffridge, and myself, Chair Sumner. Staff will be assisting us today are Kevin Allen with House Records, Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO, and Clark Bickford, my staff and committee aide to House Labor and Commerce. Today we have three items on the agenda. We were going to hear HJR 27 supporting certain U.S. trade policies, but is being rolled to Wednesday's agenda instead. Today we're going to hear House Bill 226, Pharmacies, Pharmacist Benefit Managers from my office. Then we will hear Senate Bill 196, Employer Drug and Alcohol Testing from Senator Bjorkman's office. And finishing the meeting with HB 394, RCA Regulate Natural Gas Storage Facility from House Resources. So starting with House Bill 226, we have a new version to adopt today. Vice Chair Ruffridge, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Chair Sumner. I would move to adopt committee substitute for House Bill 226, version R, also known as 33-LS0955-R.
I'll object to listen to the explanation.
Okay. And I would like to call my staff, Serena Hackenmiller, to please approach the committee, put your name on the record, and proceed with an explanation of changes. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Serena Hackenmiller. I'm staff to Rep. Sumner. Thank you for having me. I'm going to go over the explanation of changes from version S to version R. The title is amended by removing reference to pharmacies, pharmacists, and patient choice of pharmacy, and it adds references to dispensing fees. I'm just going to speak to the sections that have changes and skip over those that are the same. In Section 2, this is a new section in this bill version. It amends 0880297D2, prescription prices available to consumer. So this takes the definition of pharmacy benefit manager and moves it to a new section added to the statute later in the bill that we will see later. Section 7 is also a new section in this bill version. It amends 2127940, pharmacy audits restrictions. This expounds on the requirements of pharmacy audits. It states that the requirements under statute of an audit do not apply when there is suspected fraudulent activity.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
I might just ask questions through the sexual analysis.
Sure.
Could I just get a little more background on why this section was changed that way, please?
I might ask through the chair, Chair Sumner, if you could answer that as the bill sponsor.
Excuse me?
Can you answer that question, please, as the bill sponsor?
Let's see, which section? 7?
This is about audits.
I think some of these were at request of Division of Insurance and some were at request of other stakeholders. Perhaps Lori Winghire would like to approach and put her. Of course, I think every bill of mine is perfect. And, but sometimes changes are necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Lori Winghire. I'm the director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. Through the chair to Representative Fields, our read on this was to separate an audit from when we would not have to go through the standards of what we would an audit of when we're going in on suspected criminal activity. We already have a pretty good procedure for criminal activity or suspected criminal activity, and it's not to confuse it with an audit, just to see how the PBM is complying with the law.
I see. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please proceed, Mrs. Hackenmiller. Thank you.
For the record, again, Serena Hackenmiller, staff to Rep. Sumner. Section 8 modifies previous Section 6 slightly. The statute is 2127945B. Drug pricing list procedural requirements. So in paragraph 5, it modifies reference from the national drug database pricing to national average drug acquisition cost, or NADAC. Section 10 modifies the previous Section 8, which amended 21.27.945, Drug Pricing List Procedural Requirements. It removes previous paragraph 3, Pharmacy Acquisition Cost. Section 9 under the original bill was removed. Section 11 modifies previous Section 10 and adds a fourth new section under AS 2127. So in this modification, the first two sections here are modified and the last section here was added. So Section 2127.951, Patient Choice of Pharmacy. In paragraph 2, the language defining affiliate is removed. Previous version subsection B is removed and following subsection letters updated. Subsection D, which had been subsection C, is modified, requiring a special pharmacy to provide documentation that it holds a federal certification demonstrating its ability to distribute specialty prescriptions. Section 2127.952, Patient Access to Clinician-Administered Drugs. This modifies paragraph 3, shifts previous paragraph 3 to subparagraph A, and adds subparagraph B, saying that a health insurer or pharmacy benefits manager may not impose a penalty for using an independent pharmacy. This also removes paragraph 7 and the following paragraphs renumbered. The new section we see here in this version is Section 2127954, titled Regulations Relating to Pharmacy Benefit Manager Claims, Grievances, Activities, and Appeals. So this adds a new section to statute regarding the regulation of PBM claims and grievances. And excuse me, this is the first we are using PBM acronym. It stands for Pharmacy Benefits Managers. This section ensures regulations and standards are in place, giving pharmacies the opportunity for appropriate resolution of grievances, independent reviews of PBM activities, and requiring PBMs to hear pricing appeals. Three of these sections in the prior bill version were removed, 11, 12, and 13. Moving on to Section 12, this is a new section in this bill version, and it adds two new sections under AS 2127, the first of which is 2127960, Coverage for Dispensing Fees. So this allows the director to periodically review dispensing fees by using surveys such as the Department of Health and the National Average Drug Acquisition Cost, or NADAC, retail price survey conducted by the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare and Medicaid. The director shall negotiate dispensing fees with independent pharmacies and tribal health pharmacy providers to ensure availability of prescription medications. The director may establish differential dispensing fees based on community. There is a list of communities in this statute, community types. The director shall set and adjust dispensing fees and will do this at least every 5 years. The other section added here is the new statute for definitions. So this section has some of the definitions that had been listed under 2127955, which is repealed in this version, and combines them to be listed here in 2127975. So there are 21 definitions here, and each some of them do say where they had been moved from. Sections 15 through 18 under the original bill have been removed. In Section 13, this modifies previous Section 14, which is Unfair Trade Practices 2136520. This removes previous Section 14, paragraphs 6 through 8, but the others are still in there. They're just renumbered. Section 16 modifies previous Section 21. It adds applicability to insurance policies in addition to contracts and updates the reference sections. Section 18 modifies previous Section 23. Most of these are just updating the reference statute or regulation. So in this case, updates reference transition regulations number because of the section number in this section. Section number changes. And 19 is similar. It updates reference section number due to section number changes in this section.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Fields, you maintain your objection?
I do not.
Okay. Without objection, the committee substitute for House Bill 226 is adopted. Seeing no other questions before the committee.
One more question.
Yes.
Fields. Thank you. And I don't necessarily expect to gain full understanding of it today, but one remaining area where I feel like I don't fully understand the bill and the choices before us is with respect to rebates and whether rebates go to a consumer or a plan. And I was maybe, I don't know if it's today or at a future meeting, I wouldn't mind hearing more discussion on that, actually including from Representative Ruffridge, who has way more expertise, I think, than anyone else, and maybe Steve Ramos, too, if he's online today or next time. That's just one area where I feel like I still don't fully understand the issue. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Kerr.
Thank you to the chair or staff. It looks like we've added a definition for independent pharmacy in the definition section that wasn't there previously. Can you extrapolate on that a little bit? And then I have a different question as well.
Through the chair to Representative Carrick. So this section actually combined a number of definitions that had previously been added throughout the bill. And I'd like to follow up with you on that to see if I can find if it had been previously defined in another section. But if I recall correctly, it is a new definition.
Mr. Chairman, I can address that if you want.
Yeah, and I think it was actually so we could do some targeting towards with an eye to protecting independent pharmacies. Representative Fields?
Yeah, this is a more cost-effective way of having a mechanism to provide pharmacy coverage under the previous structure of the bill in which AlaskaCare and ERISA plans were fully encompassed and there were dispensing fees. You're essentially paying dispensing fees to all pharmacies, regardless of whether there's a pharmacy desert or adequate pharmaceutical availability, whereas the Section 12, the new section, is a more refined way of maintaining pharmaceutical access since the state does have an interest in that. So it achieves the same goal at a much lower expense and without the legal risk of encompassing ERISA plans.
Follow up to that?
Representative Carrick?
Are tribal health plans currently covered under ERISA, or is that someplace else in language?
No, tribal providers are not ERISA plans.
And just a question to the chair. That was my other question. To the chair or your staff, how does this committee substitute affect tribal health plans, if at all?
Representative Carrick, there were a number of changes. I mean, in comparison to the previous version, I would say, though, that likely they would fall under independent pharmacies, but it would probably depend. But we are going to set this bill aside and set an amendment deadline for version R of HB 226 for Thursday, April 18th at 4 p.m. Thank you, Mrs. Hackenmore. Next on the agenda is SB 196, Employer Drug and Alcohol Testing from Senator Bjorkman's office. This is a first bill hearing. I'd like to invite Senator Bjorkman and his staff to approach the committee, put your names on the record, and begin. And
thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Senator Jesse Bjorkman, representing the northern and central portions of the Kenai Peninsula. It's my honor and distinct pleasure to be with all of you esteemed House members here in Labor and Commerce today. Senate Bill 196, brought to you by the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, entitled Employer Drug and Alcohol Testing, allows the testing of oral fluids to be added to the types of testing that an employer can conduct and fall under the safe harbor provision that protects those employers from certain liabilities when they conduct this type of testing. So, testing saliva is often much simpler than testing hair, urine, or blood. It is less costly for employers and also many times can produce results faster if employees are impaired by drugs or alcohol. It doesn't require the use of a restroom, in order to test for drugs or alcohol. And it simply just adds saliva testing to the member or the type of drug testing that an employer can do and fall under that safe harbor liability protection. Thank you for your consideration. What questions do you have?
Oh, Representative Fields, through the chair. So if an employer wanted to do hair follicle testing or one that would trace the presence of drugs going back farther, they still could.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you.
Okay. No other questions? We'll set an amendment. Oh, well, we do have invited testimony. We'll start with Andy Lehman, APA counsel. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. Oh, he's not. Who do we have? We have Taya Thomas. You please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. For the record, my name is Taya Thomas, and I am a human resource manager for Bear Utilities and Electric Co-op, Inc. Well, I grew up in Kotzebue. I'm proud to call Barrow home. I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 196. For background, Busey is a customer-owned utility cooperative that provides electric, natural gas, water, and sewer services in America's northernmost city. We are owned by and exist to provide these services and a place where service interruptions can quickly become life or death situations. The challenges faced by our 70 employees are serious and never stop. The safety of our employees are our highest priority. To keep employees and the public safe, we have mandatory pre-employment, random, and for-cause testing for drugs and alcohol. Some of the employees that are required to test under the federal laws covering commercial vehicle operators and natural gas pipeline operators. Others are in the safety-sensitive positions that Busey has determined must be tested. Bringing anything or anyone to Barrow is challenging. Busey's service provider recently shuttered its doors without much notice, leaving us scrambling to find a provider who was willing and able to help us. During the COVID-19 travel restrictions, it was essentially impossible for Busey to provide independent drug and alcohol testers to travel to our community, leaving Busey supervisors to handle the collection, labeling, and shipment of urine samples to be sent out for testing. They did a great job, and so did our employees, but I'm sure you can imagine how uncomfortable and awkward this was for everyone involved. None of us had signed up to be urine collectors, but that's what we had to do to meet our legal responsibilities and maintain a safe workplace. Oral fluid testing is going to be so much better for rural employers like Busey because it never requires the kind of privacy that urine testing does. It is flexible enough that it can be performed by a trained collector in the field or even in my office. Oral fluid testing is also always administered directly by a trained collector, so it's much more difficult to cheat than a urine test. I think it's going to be a real win for Busey and its employees to switch from urine testing to oral fluid testing for drugs. As I hope I've made it clear, Busey is very interested in moving from urine testing to oral fluid testing for drugs. Once the fluid testing becomes fully approved once oral fluid testing becomes fully approved for CDL holders, Busey plans to meet with our employees and the representatives of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers to switch to oral fluid testing across the board for Busey. Not only will it be less gross and embarrassing for everyone to collect saliva instead of urine, we think it will also end up being significantly less expensive. Senate Bill 196 will allow BC to move forward with oral fluid testing. I'm not a lawyer, but our legal counsel has made it very clear that BC has significant legal protection under the Alaska Safe Harbor Drug and Alcohol Testing Law when it comes to testing urine or breath for drugs and alcohol. To get that protection, BC follows the Alaska Safe Harbor Law's requirements, including employee privacy protections and procedures to help ensure safe and accurate testing. Unfortunately, oral fluid testing did not exist when the Safe Harbor Law was passed, so it was never included in the law as a protected testing method. Senate Bill 196 would cure this inconsistency and give employers and employees the same rules and protections regardless of whether testing for drugs and alcohol involves urine, breath, or oral fluids. I hope you'll support Senate Bill 196. Koyanakpuk, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Do any committee members have questions for the senator or their invited testimony? Testifiers. No? Representative Carrick?
Through the chair, I just have a really off-the-wall question. And in general, I completely support opening up to oral testing. I'm kind of shocked that it's in statute, that that's not an acceptable form of testing currently. Just a question, is blood testing ever used? And was there ever any discussion about including that as well in situations where maybe a blood sample is taken? I don't know what that situation would be, but just curious if there's any conversation or need to open this up any further while we're at it.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Carrick, for the question. Blood testing is already a protected form under the safe harbor provisions that we are discussing.
Okay, thanks.
Apologies. I'm going to retract that statement and defer to my staff.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Carrick. In current statute, urine or breath are the two things that can be sampled by an employer. There was no discussion of blood testing. The suggestion that was brought forward to us by the Alaska Power Association was the oral fluids testing. I don't know that we've heard from any employers or employees that they would find blood testing to be preferable to urine or breath testing for any of the scenarios that they envision.
I can't imagine that would be, but thank you for thinking of it.
Thank you to the senator and his staff. I would think blood would be significantly more invasive. I mean, we also don't include brain matter or bone marrow, or, you know, so
while we are
going to set an amendment deadline for this, I'd probably encourage it to not include some things. all right. Are there any other questions from the Representative Fields?
thank you, through the chair. Totally support the bill. My only other question is, have other states adopted a standard where they might track, say, a federal law, should it become more permissive in the future? So you would have hair, urine, saliva, or some other testing, should it emerge as cheaper or more timely? I don't know if other states have approached it in that more expansive way, so we don't have to change the statute every time. Although maybe it won't be a big deal because saliva will be so cheap and fast.
Senator?
Through the chair, Representative Fields. I don't know. I don't know if other states have undertaken that.
Okay. All right. We thank you, Senator. We are going to set the bill aside for a future hearing. Amendment deadline is being set for Friday, April 19th at 11 a.m. And we will take a public testimony at that future hearing. Thank you. Last on the agenda today is HB 394, RCA Regulate Natural Gas Storage Facility, a bill from the House Resources Committee. We will take a brief at ease and track down Representative McKay or his staff.
More appointments.
Okay, we're back on the record. And let the record reflect that Representative Sadler and Representative Carrick joined us. I think it was 3:20.
It was Representative Wright that joined us at 3:20. I was here when committee started.
Oh, my apologies, Representative Carrick. Representative Wright joined us at 3:20-ish. Okay, Mr. so
Carrick, I do think it was significantly later than 3:20.
All right.
For the record.
Well, let the record reflect it was later than 3:20 then. So we have Representative McKay, Chair of House Resources, and his staff, Trevor Jepson, to present House Bill 394. Representative McKay, take it away.
Thank you, Chairman. Chairman Sumner, I really appreciate it, and it's our privilege to be before the members of the Labor and Commerce Committee today to talk about House Bill 394, the RCA regulation of natural gas storage facilities. And just before I read the sponsor statement, I'd just like to illustrate that with regard to the gas supply situation in Cook Inlet, there are a couple things we can do right away. And then there's a couple things that we can do that would be what I would call short term. And then there's intermediate term. And then there's long term. This is something that we could do rather immediately that would protect us against the cold snap situation that we had last winter. So just wanted to mention that before I read the sponsor statement. So get right into it. House Bill 394 is aimed at enhancing the energy security of South Central Alaska by providing a clear regulatory framework for third-party natural gas storage. This bill was designed to establish a regulatory framework that not only encourages the expansion of natural gas and liquefied natural gas or LNG storage facilities, but also ensures these critical pieces of energy infrastructure operate efficiently and remain economically viable. House Bill 394 provides for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, or RCA, to have clear oversight authority over natural gas and LNG storage facilities, which will bring stability and predictability to the sector and make it more attractive to operators and investors. HB 394 defines principles for the determination of just and reasonable rates, ensuring that operation costs, tax incentives, and the fair market value of storage assets are all considered. This approach aims to foster fair pricing practices that benefit both consumers and businesses. This bill also introduces measures to protect sensitive financial information, mandating confidentiality for certain records. This move strikes a balance between protecting commercial sensitivities and fulfilling the need for regulatory transparency. Additionally, the bill recognizes the complexities of state and federal regulations by exempting LNG import facilities that are already regulated by the federal government from state oversight. House Bill 394 is a necessary piece of legislation if the state of Alaska wants to see third-party gas storage from the private sector, particularly in Cook Inlet. I urge my colleagues of the 33rd Legislature to join me in supporting this bill, which represents a decisive step towards reinforcing South Central Alaska's energy infrastructure and ensuring the well-being of our state. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll now turn it over to my Chief of Staff, Trevor Jepson, who can give you a slide presentation on the bill.
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Representative McKay. Thank you, Chair Sumner and the rest of the House Labor and Commerce Committee for being here today to hear HB 394 dealing with RCA regulation of gas storage facilities. HB 394 was a bill crafted to set the stage and encourage third-party gas storage in Cook Inlet in light of the projected gas production shortages that are on the horizon right now. Currently, there's only one commercial gas storage facility in Cook Inlets. That's the natural gas, the Cook Inlet Natural Gas Storage Alaska, or CINGSA, which is operated by NSTAR. And South Central is heavily dependent on it, and it has a working storage capacity of 11 BCF. In order to increase storage volume for excess gas produced in the warmer summer months, which is needed for colder winter months, and to be prepared for potential liquefied natural gas imports, our state needs to capitalize on other depleted reservoirs in Cook Inlet for storage. The issue with having only one storage reservoir was highlighted earlier this year in February when CINGSA had production issues during a cold snap. Even if CINGSA had a larger gas storage capacity, we should still be focused on increasing gas storage both in terms of volume and individual storage units as a redundancy measure in case we have issues with CINGSA moving forward. Next, we'll go over the four depleted reservoirs currently in the state that could be used for gas storage or actively being used for gas storage. First is CINGSA, which was established in 2011. It has an 11 BCF working volume, 18 BCF total storage capacity. We'll go into a little bit more of those terms on the next slide. CINGSA is RCA regulated and operated by NSTAR. The second is Kenai Gas Pool 6, which was established in 2006. That's owned by Hillcorp and it's unregulated. It has 17.5 BCF working volume with 50 BCF total storage capacity. And Hillcorp is very confident that that storage capacity could be increased significantly, and it's larger than 50 BCF.
Representative Fields. Thanks. Through the chair, if I just ask a clarifying question. So third party for this slide would not include CINGSA, would include Hillcorp.
So this bill addresses both of the storage and CINGSA and Hillcorp is
addressed by this bill.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, of course. So moving on, Kenai Pretty Creek was established in 2005 with roughly 3 BCF working volume, 2.9 BCF working volume, and 3 BCF total storage capacity. Another unregulated storage facility operated by Hillcorp. And these facilities are unregulated because there's no, they're just being used for Hillcorp's upstream gas business, and there's not selling it into any process that the RCA is associated with at that point in time. And the fourth is Swanson River. This is a federal lease, the Kenai and the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. It was established in 2001 with 3 BCF of working volume and 3.4 BCF total storage capacity, and yet another storage unit that's unregulated currently and operated by Hillcorp. So gas storage and depleted reservoirs can be summarized at a high level by the graphic on this slide, which was provided by the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Oil and Gas. Storage consists of injector wells powered by compressors. Storage consists of injector wells powered by compressors and also producer wells. At any given time, you have a certain amount of gas referred to as cushion or pad gas that has to remain in the reservoir to maintain pressure and manage the flow rate of gas via the producer wells for normal operations. The reservoir pressure drops too low, your flow rates will decrease to a level that doesn't meet peak demand. The maximum volume that can be produced is referred to as working gas, and inventory gas refers to the sum of the two and represents the total volume of gas in the reservoir. So we'll use CINGSA as an example here. It has a full capacity of 18 BCF inventory gas, but 11 BCF of that is working gas, with 7 BCF being cushion or pad gas. So that's why when people refer to CINGSA, they say it has 11 BCF of storage, even though technically there's more gas in there. So here we have a thorough summary put together by the DNR, which explains how the delineation of duties between the three state organizations which engage in gas storage activities. AOGCC manages subsurface operations, such as injection volumes, well integrity tests, maximum injection volumes and pressures, and review yearly performance reporting. Department of Natural Resources manages lease agreements and terms, ensures the terms are followed, and monitors gas injection and withdrawal cycles. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska ensures safe operations of facilities and regulates just and reasonable rates of gas storage, which are ultimately passed on to the consumer. They currently have the authority to regulate facilities with third-party storage. However, reforms to the regulatory framework, which HB 394 represents, are needed in order to expand storage facilities beyond our one commercial facility, CESA, and allow more private sector players to engage in the market. So HB 394, an overview before we go into the sectional, it clarifies the regulation of natural gas and liquefied natural gas shortage operations to the RCA under Chapter 5 of Title 42. It exempts LNG import facilities that are already regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. Clarifies that the market value costs related to gas storage operations will be considered when determining just and reasonable rates. And it creates a confidentiality requirement related to financial statements of entities who provide gas storage operations. And just for clarification, there's currently already a petition process with the RCA that you can not hide if you want to make your financial statements confidential. But what this bill would do is it just makes that confidentiality immediate, and you don't have to petition for it. And Chair Sumner, that's the end of the presentation. If there's questions or sectional, whatever the will of the committee is.
Okay, and we also have Robert Doyle, Chair of the RCA, and John Sims, President of NSTAR, online for questions. Representative Fields.
Thank you. I do have a question, maybe best asked of Mr. Sims through the chair. Mr. Sims, I think the main difference between House Bill 394 and, well, there are a couple differences between 394 and the Senate companion, is this fair market value language. So in 394, it's on page 2. It seems to me that the fair market value language could increase the price of gas storage if global gas prices increased. Is that an accurate assumption, or am I misreading what could happen under this language? Thank you.
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Representative McKay, I can take a stab at that one. I put the language in there if you want me to.
Sure.
Right, for the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Chair McKay. So the reason behind putting the fair market value language in there was just to kind of clarify and signal to the private industry that the cost of your assets, both what they were originally purchased for and any investment you made into them, is going to be used when calculating that fair and reasonable rate. There is a little bit of ambiguity with it, because technically fair market value is assessed at the point of sale, but we're just trying to put language in there that makes it so the private sector knows that other things are going to be considered, despite just what did you pay for the asset and how old is it. And the changes that you were alluding to, these were done specifically to have the private sector engage in this market. And we're trying to make this bill more friendly to that, because if we pass a bill and the private sector doesn't want to engage because of how it's written, then we didn't pass a very useful bill.
Thank you. Pass the follow-up. Through the chair, help me understand, the price of gas has no impact on the cost of storage, right? I mean, my assumption is if an investor wants to store gas, they will do so based on their forecasts of likely prices over time and make a judgment about whether it's going to be profitable or not. But the cost of actually storing the gas will not vary based on global prices, right?
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Representative McKay. I believe that's correct. I think I'd agree with that assessment.
Mr. Chairman, if Mr. Sims is online, could I just ask that through the chair that he comment on this? Or if he's not online, maybe we could get his input later.
I am online. I apologize for not speaking up earlier. I had my mute button on. So this is John Sims for the record, through the chair, Representative Field. So the fair market value question is actually one that comes up quite regularly in the regulated world for utilities. And the challenge is, you know, determining that initial point in time at which rates are set. And so it's my understanding that that is what this is intending to clarify. There are really three ways in which you can set the fair market value. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska has it within their authority and their power to set that fair market value after a process. There have been other times when it has been sort of a negotiated fair market value that's set for the initial rate making process. And then probably the most public is some sort of arm's length transaction where there's a, you know, one entity that acquires either all or a portion of it, and that would give you a, you know, very open setting of fair market value. So that's, I believe, what that's intended to do. As far as whether or not the, you know, the price of gas, whether it's here in Cook Inlet or on the world market, that is a separate subject and should not be determining fair market value as far as rates go for storage facilities.
Guess a follow-up. Follow-up through the chair. Mr. Sims, I'm wondering if you could provide us information on the historic cost of gas storage at CINGSA versus if you were to do a retrospective analysis of this fair market language, what would that have produced in terms of prices paid by utilities and thus consumers over a period of time? Does that make sense? So I want to compare what would prices have been to consumers and utilities either without this fair market language or with it, and maybe we could then come to some conclusion about which one is better for consumers.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Field, that's a difficult analysis that, quite honestly, would require some legal opinion that I don't have available. I will tell you that CINGSA's rates were a combination of two things. One, there was a acquisition, so CINGSA acquired the reservoir from Marathon at the time, along with some base gas, as was discussed and defined earlier. In addition to that, there was capital investment required to create the facility. So that's how CINGSA formed the initial starting point of its rates. I don't believe there would be any impact from this legislation because of that acquisition portion, but I would ask my legal team for some assistance on that.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Carrick, and then.
Thank you, through the chair. Why make the records confidential if producers can already request confidentiality on records?
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Representative McKay. We believe this is necessary in the bill because you're just not going to see the private sector engage and file an application to register their storage for third party if there's no clarification that their confidential records are going to be kept private. So we need to give that that level of confidence that's going to be respected instead of making them go through a petition process after they've already got their storage facility registered. And I would refer to Chairman Doyle if he wants to comment on that particular portion of the bill or how the RCA views that.
Mr. Doyle, if you're on, please put your name on the record, and if you would like to address the representative's question.
My name is Robert Doyle. I'm with the RCA, currently the chair, through the chair. We support this bill. We think we're in a situation where it's kind of a new normal. I think we need to start talking about adequacy a little bit more than affordability. Long term, I think when we're taking a look at legacy fields versus brand new fields, it's a matter of timing. Can we bring on a new field as quickly as we can convert a legacy field into a storage facility? So we're in support of this. We do believe that this is going to require some work, some new things. It's a little bit different than our normal setting of prudently incurred, known and measurable, you know, cost of an asset when it's put into service. We're going to have to take a look at a lot of new things. And in terms of the confidentiality, we do grant those. We do grant them by petition. We believe getting new players, new private sector into the process, if we can give them some additional support with some additional confidentiality, I would support that. I think that we just need to do whatever it takes, and I'll count on the legislature to put the policy framework in there in terms of saying what you want us to consider and not, and we will carry that out. But we support this legislation for gas storage.
Follow-up? So, Commissioner Doyle, can you explain a little bit further why the current request process for confidentiality is cumbersome or ineffective, and why it would potentially prevent folks from getting into the market, which was stated earlier, I'm having a trouble understanding why that would be true when it's not true for current utilities, to our knowledge. Or is it?
Basically, through the chair, this is Robert Doyle again. I don't believe it's ineffective. I believe that we have an effective system. It is based upon a petition, and we do have what's called, in our own terms, a mighty might standard, which is if it might cause harm to the entity, we will protect the confidentiality of it. We will make adjustments in our hearing process. We will make adjustments in our non-disclosure process. We have the two parties would get together and come up with what they believe is a adequate confidentiality agreement. So we believe the current process does work. We just believe we're in kind of a new era where we need to do whatever we possibly can to make sure we have the adequate storage and the adequate energy supplies to meet the needs of Alaskans. And I'll leave it to the legislature to make the policy decision of how much confidentiality you wish to grant.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Doyle, or to the sponsor if he wants to take it. I guess I just want to probe that section four a little bit more. We're talking about records held or our confidentiality and lists. But financial statements and financial assurance agreements. I'm not a finance guy. Can you explain to me what those two different terms are? And next I'm going to ask you what is not included in these. But so what is a financial statement and what is a financial assurance agreement?
For the record.
A lot of what you... through the chair, this is Robert Doyle with the RCA. One of the differences is how far somebody wants to go in terms of exploring those financial statements. Sometimes it's far past just the local. Say somebody sets up the company to do the storage agreement here but has financial support beyond that. So in many cases, it's how far into the financial records somebody wants to go. And I have staff member Becky Alvey here. Becky, do you want to try and explore that a little farther?
For the record, Becky Alvey, the advisory section manager at the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Financial statements, what we're getting is balance statements, liability sheets, some of those items which are frequently filed when we are getting like a rate case or a revenue requirement study. Which will indicate kind of where the utility is financially versus the financial assurances. Just to speak very briefly about the confidentiality, we have process laid out in regulation and things that we do consider confidential from filing versus things that can be classified as confidential with that petition.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Alvey, through the chair, please define a financial assurance agreement. Just a definition, please.
I believe the financial assurance agreement would be something where you would have the financial backing of a third party. Somebody else is backing up. It's where you would go to get your investment from, to have somebody else, an investor who would put, it's kind of having a third-party investor that's pricing your assets and is backing up the organization with hard assets. That, without getting into a legal definition, and we can supply that in writing if you wish, but that's probably as far as I want to do that without getting the full legal opinion that we can get to.
Sounds like through the chair. Sounds like your investors, your backers. Okay, and then records held by da-da-da include financial statements and include financial assurance agreements. What is not included? I guess that is. Oh gosh, I guess that's not a question. Yeah, I'm not disputing the need for confidentiality. I'm just trying to figure out how far the confidentiality extends. We've got the two, for examples, including financial statements and including financial assurance agreements. I guess I don't know what is not covered and therefore what is public record, if anything.
Through the chair, this is Robert Doyle again. One of the things that's a little bit complex in terms of just my legal understanding of it, we're talking about the S corporations, and I believe that Hillcorp is a different corporation than it is for Instar and the the Tri-Summit, that the owner and how the holding company for SINCSA exists. So that's why I'm going to want to get a legal opinion to make sure that I'm not misleading or misstating the facts here.
I think if I could, Mr. Chairman, just say it real simply. We need additional gas storage beyond what's at SINCSA. Mm-hmm. And if we wrote the bill so that that operator would participate in that additional capacity. So if we don't have those protections on confidentiality, then we won't have access to that additional storage. That's pretty simple as that.
Representative Fields. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is Ledge legal online?
We do not have.
Okay. Maybe legal online. Maybe at a future hearing, I'd be interested in asking them about this confidentiality language in the context of past confidentiality for oil.
We do have Derek Nottingham, the Director of Division of Oil and Gas of Department of Natural Resources.
Well, maybe through the chair, I could ask Mr. Nottingham, for those of us who are not familiar with these terms that Representative Sadler just talked about, could you contextualize this confidentiality language relative to other confidentiality language the division has worked with in the past?
Yeah, for the record, this is Derek Nottingham. I can speak to what I know of from the oil and gas context regarding financial assurances and the purposes of them, and just give a little context on how we would go about assessing that. The purpose of it is mainly to ensure that a company that starts an oil and gas operation in the state of Alaska, whether it's profitable or not, has the financial backing to basically DR&R that facility, whether they make one drop of oil, whether they're profitable or not. And so what we're really looking at is making sure that the company doesn't leave us, for lack of a better term, high and dry, and responsible for the abandonment and reclamation of any oil and gas site. So when it comes to looking at financial statements, what we are looking at is the balance sheet of those companies, their operational performance, performing calculations that I don't know the formulas to by heart for sure, but to ensure that they've got the financial wherewithal to meet that requirement. And we apply that in a variety of different ways, depending on the company, whether it's a large company. Sometimes there's a parental guarantee that's sufficient. If it's a smaller company with not as, you know, quite the asset base, and it may be in the form of bonds and those kinds of things. So that's a little bit of the context from the oil and gas side.
Representative Fields. If I could ask a follow-up of Mr. Nottingham. So the language in here says that the records, quote, are confidential and are not public records under the Alaska Public Records Act. So the way this bill is written is are confidential, broadly speaking, and are confidential from the Alaska Public Records Act, two different things. In other words, says the first broad confidentiality exclude such records from your division, the RCA, beyond what the public can see through the APRA.
For the record, through the chair, we have statutes that protect the confidentiality of those records within DNR's statutes.
Mr. Chairman, that didn't really answer the question. What I'm asking is, does this language go farther than existing statutes related to confidentiality for what you can see, not for what the public can see? Thank you.
For the record, this is Derek Nottingham, through the chair. I don't think I can comment on that at this point.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the chair, to the bill sponsor, I have a couple questions. First one, So from my understanding, one of the bigger issues is having enough storage, particularly in Cook Inlet, when there is a need, particularly in winter when the weather is cold. How does HB 394 get us to that place? I guess I'm trying to draw the lines. I'm not certain. I'm missing something somewhere. How does it get us more storage?
Well, right now, Mr. Through the Chair, Representative Rutledge, right now we only have access to CINCSA. The three Hillcourt properties are not included in our inventory. This bill would enable us to access, assuming Hillcourt would agree, we could access the Hillcourt, what do we call it, the void reservoirs on that earlier list. So that would increase our storage substantially. Now, when and if we are able to receive LNG, remember, you could have a large tanker of LNG come in June. You're going to have somewhere to put it because it doesn't go right to NSTAR. It doesn't go right to the market. It's got to go to storage. And CINCSA may not have enough storage for a full tanker of LNG. So this is looking ahead to the days when we may, if we wish to, and if we need to, import LNG, we have a place to put it. And so we're trying to go from one storage facility to four. And that's what this bill enables. Without this bill, we're stuck at one, CINCSA. Does that help? I hope.
Just a couple follow-ups, if I may, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So I guess, well, I'll ask my second question, then I'll maybe ask a follow-up to that. Second question was in Section 5 of the bill, there's some repealed language. I'm assuming that is to accomplish the task that you just outlined for us. But it does not repeal any reference to North Slope natural gas pipeline facilities. What is the reason for repealing all the language in reference to pipeline facilities, but still allowing North Slope natural gas to be exempted in this bill in Section 5?
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Representative McKay. So currently, the gas storage and gas transfer is regulated under the Pipeline Act for any pipeline carrier. So this is really just conforming language to designate that instead of being regulated under Chapter 6, which is the Pipeline Act, natural gas pipeline facilities and carriers are going to be regulated under Chapter 5, which is the general powers of the RCA. So it's really just conforming language for the bill. And if you want to talk more in depth about the Pipeline Act, I think I'd refer to Becky Alvey if she wants to go more in depth on the differences between Chapter 5 and Chapter 6 of Title 42.
Just a follow-up to that, if I may. To clarify, so... Essentially, you're saying, Mr. Jepson, Section 5's language that is repealed is added in the bill under a new subsection that is in Section 7?
So, chapter in Section 5, which is Chapter 5, Title 42, it's referencing language that we see in Chapter 6 at the very end there of Section 5. It says, have the meanings given in AS 4206. So it's removing those so that the Pipeline Act is now only going to be confined to regulating a North Slope pipeline or pipeline carriers. So it's delineating the two for pipeline carriers. As to do natural gas storage, you're going to have a pipeline of some sort.
Okay. Follow up again, Mr. Chair. I think that actually brings me back to my original question. I thought I understood what you said the first time, which was I thought that Section 5, the language removed, was now moved down to a new subsection inside Chapter 6, which is references Section 7 of the bill. But now I guess my previous question is now sort of back on the table, which is why make North Slope natural gas carriers different than all the other carriers?
I think I'll defer to Becky Alvey to maybe go into the differences in the Pipeline Act and how that would affect whether they're regulated under the Pipeline Act or whether they're regulated under Chapter 5 for general RCA powers.
And Ms. Alvey?
For the record, Becky Alvey with the Regulatory Commission. Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge. So in AS 4206, which is the Pipeline Act, natural gas pipeline or gas pipeline or pipeline carriers and then North Slope are specifically carved out separately. We define them separately and based on location, and then North Slope, probably partially because of the Trans-Alaska pipeline, has been regulated kind of under its operation in 06, in 4206. But we do deal with gas pipeline carriers in the Cook Inlet also under 4206. We also deal with them as utilities under AS 4205. But I will note that it's not unusual in 4206 to have a carve out for the North Slope separate from just a pipeline carrier.
Well, let me, maybe I can help Mr. Chairman, Tom McKay again. it is complicated. It's not easy to explain. You have FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, that regulates certain pipelines, and then you have the State Pipeline Act, right? So when we say Pipeline Act, we mean State of Alaska, okay? So, and we're trying to, the bill is only for Cook Inlet. Nothing to do with the slope. So that's why we have language in there that delineates the two. So this gas storage is only for, this bill is only for Cook Inlet. Okay. Yeah. Gotta explain it real simple.
So I guess that follow-up, if I may, Mr. Chair. So I think that is, again, the basis for my question. Which is, you know, we've talked a lot about accessing North Slope natural gas, how there is, you know, a plethora of natural gas provided on the North Slope. I find it interesting, if this bill is to be forward-looking, that we wouldn't want to bring potentially North Slope gas from the North Slope to another area. And maybe because there's a lot of gas there, we might want to store some of that. It seems odd to sort of just carve out one specific area and say we're only going to regulate or store gas that comes out of Cook Inlet. When realistically we have talked a lot about bringing North Slope gas out, off the North Slope, via pipeline. So that's really where that question is coming from. I'm sorry to be confusing with.
For the record, Trevor Jefferson, staff representing McKay. I think we're understanding your question now, and I think to answer it fully, I need to do a little bit more research into the Pipeline Act and some of these definitions. If Ms. Alvey's answer wasn't sufficient, I think I probably just need to do more research on that.
Okay, thank you.
And through the chair, Tom McKay, through the chair, Sumner, Representative Ruffridge, you know, you have to regulate all gas pipelines, even if they might be like half a mile long. They might go from the LNG facility at Nikiski to the Kenai Pool 6, which I'm not sure exactly how far that is, but it's probably within a couple miles, but you still have to regulate that. We were looking at the immediate future for this bill, and then we were looking at the importation of LNG, which could possibly happen as early as 2030, we're told. We didn't really consider the transmission of North Slope gas through a North Slope gas pipeline going the whole distance of the state, although I think that could be amended or would require a new bill is all. Right.
Yep. For the record, Trevor Jefferson, staff to represent McKay. I would agree with that. We were trying to make this bill just apply to Cook Inlet, not muddy the waters and, you know, bring in the discussion of a North Slope gas pipeline. But maybe we could talk to Ledge Legal and see if there would be a reason to bring it all under Chapter 5. Maybe that's what you're wondering, Representative Ruffords, through the chair.
I think that is certainly a question is trying to be forward looking if there is any sort of appetite to bring North Slope gas to Alaskan either market or for energy consumption. Theoretically, there would be a need for maybe substantial storage. And if so, it seems that maybe it seems like this bill prohibits that from falling under the RCA Chapter 5 components that are the bill is addressing now. So it's something we can obviously talk about offline. I'm sorry to take up so much committee time, but that's just trying to be a little forward-looking if there is North Slope gas at some point.
Hey, Representative Carrick.
Through the chair, I'm looking at Section 6 now, and it says that natural gas import facilities under jurisdiction of FERC are exempt from the chapter. How many natural gas facilities in the state would this exempt? And are we, when we say import facility, are we talking about in this section also North Slope production facilities, or what is exempted in Section 6?
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Representative McKay. There's currently no operating LNG import facilities, but there is a potential project in the Marathon refinery that does currently have a FERC license to import LNG. So if that project were to go ahead, then Section 6 would just clarify that the federal regulations take precedence over RCA regulations, and we can avoid any double regulation issues that might arise. And also, once again, I would invite Chairman Doyle or Ms. Alvey to comment on how they view this section of the bill, the exemption for federally regulated facilities.
This is Robert Doyle from the RCA. We support the carve-out. We believe that FERC should be the one that leads out on this regulation, and they shouldn't be double regulated.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you to the chair. And I think, Mr. Doyle, this question might go to you. I'm looking at Section 1 of the bill, and I confess that I still have some confusion about some of the nuances in the terminology. We speak of a pipeline facility operated by a pipeline carrier and a natural gas pipeline facility operated by a natural gas pipeline carrier. And so I'm just trying to understand the reason for the distinction. So speaking generally and not technically, I'm going to read and ask if what I'm reading describes what SINGSA is. Is SINGSA storage furnished by operating a natural gas storage facility that is part of a natural gas pipeline facility operated by a natural gas pipeline carrier? And a simple yes or no, please.
No.
No. Okay, then I'm going to ask you, speaking generally again, what are the two circumstances or types of organizations or types of pipeline things that are envisioned that this applies to? The interlocking definitions is what's throwing me, frankly.
I need you to restate that question, please.
What two, you know, we have in Section 1, subparagraph 1 and subparagraph 2. Generally speaking, what are these two subparagraphs describing? So I guess my question is, what is a pipeline facility operated by a pipeline carrier?
For the record, this is Becky Alley with the RCA. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, AS 4206, 630 defines what a pipeline facility is and a pipeline carrier, and they are specific under the Pipeline Act. For this section right now, without the change that happens in section, I believe it's section 5 of this bill, where in 711Q, that would take out the pipeline facility operated by a pipeline carrier or the natural gas pipeline facility. They would otherwise be exempt from AS 4205 because they would be regulated under AS 4206.
Through the chair, Ms.
And that's...
Through the chair. Okay, having read through the definition section, spent a fair amount of time trying to understand and not getting it, so please, what is a pipeline facility operated by a pipeline carrier? If you have an example, that might be good.
Through the chair, Becky Alvey for the Regulatory Commission. So a pipeline carrier is, or a pipeline facility is the facility of the pipeline, operated by the entity that is determined to be a pipeline carrier, who is the owner of the pipeline. For example,
you lost me again. What is a pipeline carrier? Is that the owner?
The pipeline carrier is the owner through the chair.
Okay. That's good. Good. Simple answer. What is a pipeline facility?
Through the chair, the pipeline facility is the pipe, the equipment, the facility for the pipeline carrier, compressors, pumps, station equipment, other facilities used or necessary for the pipeline to effectuate transportation.
Okay. And what is, through the chair again, follow up, what is the distinction between a pipeline facility operated by a pipeline carrier and a natural gas pipeline facility operated by natural gas pipeline carrier? Why the distinction between those two? Is one oil and the other gas?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, yes, one would be pipeline for oil and one would be pipeline for natural gas.
Great. That answers a whole bunch of questions for me. Thank you, Ms. Helby.
And if I may, this is John Sims for the record, through the chair, Representative Sadler, for a real life example in the Cook Inlet market. So Harvest is a pipeline carrier, and they're regulated under 4206. And I'm not sure how familiar you are with the pipeline map, but the KBPL pipeline is a pipeline facility under 4206. Just to give some examples there in the Cook Inlet market.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else? Representative Fields?
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor, there's a term getting back to Section 2, fair return on fair market value of those assets. What is there a definition of fair return in the statutes? What rate of profit is that? And if it's not defined in statutes, who defines it? Or what would you envision as a fair rate of profit?
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Representative McKay. Because we have Chairman Doyle on the line, once again, I would defer to him and his staff, Becky Alvey, to how they interpret this language and how they would craft their reasonable rates based on the return.
Through the chair, this is Robert Doyle. Coming up with a fair and justifiable rate is going to be a process that's not determined by legislation. It's not going to be determined ahead of time. We wouldn't create our own record. The parties would bring forward the revenue requirements that it's required. They would bring forth supporting evidence that they would present on the record. We would make a decision based upon the facts on that record and come up with what we believe would be a fair market return for the investments and for the rate that would be charged to the ratepayers as well. So, but that would be based on the record and on facts that are presented to the commission.
If I could ask a follow up, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Doyle, I'd like to get a little more specificity on what you see as, I think what you described as revenue requirements. One way would be, hey, a company is not going to invest if there's not a, pick a percentage, 8% rate of return. Another way of looking at it would be maybe there's a company that also has other assets in state and, you know, is making a 50% profit margin on, say, North Slope oil at current oil prices? Could a company come in and say, well, we're making a 50% profit margin on our North Slope oil assets, so to invest a marginal dollar in Cook Inlet, we would need a 50% rate of return on Cook Inlet because the company will be investing their limited dollars in those areas where they can reap the highest rate of return. Could either of those serve to be to meet the rubric of what you describe as a revenue requirement?
Through the chair, this is Robert Doyle again. They would have to present in the case for the hearing. They would present proxies. They would present evidence to the commission. It would be challenged by RAPA. They would present proxies on the public interest for the ratepayers, and that whole process would be put through. Where again, we would start with what's been prudently incurred, what's known and measurable, cost causer, cost payer. We would take a look at all of the depreciations, and I think it's not a predetermined outcome that somebody would sit down and say, I need to have 15% or I'm not going to invest. It wouldn't be that kind of a situation. They'd have to sit down and make the case. They would have to sit down and say, why is that? Is there some risks? Are there things that they're facing that no other industry or utility is facing in that process? And so it wouldn't be where somebody would say, if I don't get 50%, I'm not going to invest. I need to have that. And that would be the rate of return we come up with. That's not what we go through. We go through a process to determine what's in the public interest.
Can I ask one more follow-up, Mr. Chairman? I'm curious if Mr. Doyle or the bill sponsors have contemplated other means of developing storage. One method is basically pay as much as it takes for a for-profit company to open up storage. Another method would be direct ADA investment and have an equity stake in the state opening up storage. Have other methods been contemplated in case you have, say, a company out there that is making very healthy profits somewhere else and frankly doesn't have a huge incentive to invest in Cook Inlet storage right now?
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Representative McKay. We believe that crafting a piece of legislation that would allow the current depleted reservoirs to be opened up for storage is the most prudent and effective method of getting more storage online. If ADA would want to invest in gas storage, I mean, that'd be great too. But if we want the private sector to engage, we're going to need a piece of legislation like House Bill 394 with some of these differences than the Senate bill that you referenced earlier, Representative Fields. Through the chair.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair to Commissioner Doyle. You said a little bit earlier in our conversation here that a fair rate is not determined by legislation. It's decided by RCA based on evidence that's developed in the record. That's great. So my question, fair is a bit of a subjective term, I guess. Does RCA now make allowable rates of return decisions based on a fair rate standard? I think there's just some curiosity to understand what is considered fair. I understand the factors considered, but at some point it becomes subjective what is fair. It's not market-based. It's not average. What constitutes fair?
Through the chair, I think that's a really good question. I think one of the things you have to take into account is, again, the revenue requirements, because you also need to have a utility that actually can be viable over time and can actually maintain the service and provide the service that they're being expected to under their certificate. So coming up with that is what is fair isn't, it's what's justified, what's fair, what's supported on the record, and how all of those, the revenue requirements of what it takes for the company to exist with a fair margin. I worked for 12 years as a board of directors on the MEA board, and so what we have is what would be called margins, and we also return margins to the ratepayers in that area. But it wouldn't; those margins are like a profit, but it's actually what you would take to operate the facility to make sure you've got your cash flows, to make sure you can meet your needs. And so, I don't. If you sat down and said, we think that a fair return is 4%, that's in a legislative piece, I guess we would have to carry out that statute. But absent that, we would take a look at the facts in the hearing, what's been presented by both parties and all the interveners to that party, and come up with what we believe as a commission makes sense for the public interest, which includes both the ratepayers and the utilities. I don't know if I can be more specific than that.
That's good. Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Commissioner Boyle. No, I think that's reasonable, and I think that RCA is already employing those methods and considering those factors in making decisions on rates for the things it currently regulates. So I think we as a state and we as a legislature are already deferring to RCA to a certain extent to make fair decisions. So I just want to make sure there's not some other factor impinging on what fair is that might be different to what you already do. So I'm satisfied. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Representative McKay. Seeing no other questions before the committee on HB 394, we're going to set this bill aside for a future date. We'll set an amendment deadline for HB 394 for Wednesday, April 17th at 11 a.m. Is there any other business before the committee? Yeah, seeing none, that concludes our business today. We will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 4:47 p.m.